Mr. Groucho Marx, Mr. Chico Marx, Mr. Robert Emmett Dolan. Senor Jose Iturbe, celebrated pianist and conductor, will be initiated at tonight's meeting. In the Minstrels Gallery are Mr. Dolan's orchestra and the foursome. Members of the circle, your president, Mr. Ronald Coleman.
The meeting will please come to order. Let's proceed directly to unfinished business, of which it seems we have a large supply. For example, there's the strange case of the janitor, Ravelli, who keeps telling me the club owes him $15. And then there's the mystery of the singing beetle. From certain facts that have come to my attention, it seems our beetle intends to sing tonight. How about it, Kerry?
Well, Ronnie, as a matter of fact, Bobby Dolan and I have worked up a little thing, you know, just in case.
Oh, of course he didn't expect to be called on. He just happened to have a bass fiddle with him.
Bass fiddles have nothing to do with it, Carol. I'm going to sing a song for a friend of mine in New York.
Oh, who is he, Carol?
Noel Card. I'm going to make a stab at one of Noel's songs.
Well, after all, friendship can't last forever.
No, we mustn't delay this musical outburst a moment longer. Which of Noel's songs have you prepared?
For the slaughter.
Oh. Well, Ronnie, I got in touch with Noel by wire, and we thrashed the matter out. Now, here are the wires, quite a batch of them. Anyway, now, suppose I read mine, and you read his replies, Ronnie.
Very good. Delighted to act for Noel. Go ahead, Beetle.
All right. First telegram. Cary Grant to Noel Card. Would like to sing something of yours this Sunday. Any suggestions?
Noel Card to Cary Grant. Why not Mad Dogs and Englishmen? Sturdy little number, can absorb punishment like a sponge.
Grant to Coward. Mad Dogs and Englishmen dates back too far. Haven't you something new?
Coward to Grant. Have a new neurosis, a new pair oddly repulsive lounging pajamas. Am sure will be pleased your treatment, Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Grant to Coward. Don't like Mad Dogs and Englishmen. What do you think of that?
Coward to Grant. I don't like chopped liver and Brooklyn Bridge. Shall we arbitrate?
Grant to Coward. How about writing me a new song?
Coward to Grant. You can't reach me.
Grant to Coward. Don't want you. Want song.
Coward to Grant. Fearfully sorry, just had idea. Why not sing Mad Dogs and Englishmen?
Grant the Coward, why didn't you say so before? In tropical climes, there are certain times of day when all the citizens retire to tear their clothes off and perspire. It's one of those rules that the greatest fools obey. Because the sun is much too sultry and one must avoid its ultra violet ray.
Papa like a papa like a boo. Papa like a papa like a papa like a boo. Digga rigga digga rigga digga rigga doo. Digga rigga digga rigga digga rigga doo.
The natives grieve when the white men leave their huts because they're obviously definitely nuts. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The Japanese don't care to. The Chinese wouldn't dare to. The Hindus and Argentines sleep firmly 12 to 1. But Englishmen detest a siesta. In a jungle town where the sun beats down to the rage of man and beast, the English garb of the English sub merely gets more creased. In Bangkok at 12 o'clock they foam at the mouth and run, but
mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun.
It's such a surprise for Eastern eyes to see that though the English are effete, they're quite impervious to heat. When the white man rides, every native hides in glee. Because the simple creatures hope he will impale his solar topi on a tree. It seems such a shame when the English claim the earth that they give rise to such hilarity and mirth.
Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun.
The toughest vermi bandit can never understand it. In Rangoon, the heat of noon is just what the natives shun. They put their scotch or ride down and lie down. In the mangrove swamps where the pythons romp, there is peace from 12 to 2. Even caribous lie around and snooze, for there's nothing else to do. In Bengal, to move at all is seldom, if ever, done. But
mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday, out in the midday, out in the midday sun.
A remarkable effort, Kerry.
Me, I'm all out of breath.
Is it the thought of the circle that our beetle produced a remarkable effort?
Oh, it was remarkable.
It was an effort.
You know, I can see thousands of Englishmen and thousands of home sitting down and writing thousands of nasty letters.
I can see thousands of mad dogs picketing the SPCA.
Well, if it comes to that, I can see that Carey must be encouraged in his good works. However, we stand face to face now with a solemn moment in the brief annals of this society. We face, in fact, a crisis.
What's the matter? Is the joint pinched?
No. No, nothing like that, Groucho. We are about to initiate our first new member, Jose Iturbi. And I've been rather at a loss to know what to do about it.
Maybe he can sing Mad Dogs in English when we can't get too much of that.
Well, that'd be interesting, but hardly appropriate. I've asked Carol and Carey, who seem to have ideas on the subject, to prepare an initiation ceremony. Beetle?
The candidate is prepared, Mr. President.
And where is the candidate?
In the vestibule, bound and blindfolded.
Well, not gagged, I hope.
No, we couldn't find a good gag.
I've had that trouble myself.
You'll escort the candidate into the presence of the circle, Beetle.
Your servant, Mr. President. Mr. President, I present the neophyte Iturbi.
Remove the blindfold. Senor Iturbi, greetings. You are now at the mercy of Miss Lombard and Mr. Grant.
I'm delighted. Who could ask for more?
Oh, Spaniards are so polite, you know, it's slaughter, Carey. I don't think I have the heart. He's such a lamb.
Oh, now pull yourself together, Toots. Did you bring the paddle?
One thing, Carey.
Yes, Ronnie.
No paddles.
No paddles?
No paddles.
No paddles? Well, Ronnie, how do you expect? Well, who ever heard of... Oh, well, for holy smokes. Yeah. Well, there goes the whole ceremony.
Oh, yeah. Now, look, Ronnie, he's got to assume the angle. Oh, definitely.
No.
Why, Ronnie, it's fundamental. No one was ever initiated into anything standing upright.
No. Sorry, Carey. We've got to keep this on a higher plane.
Well, that's all very well, but you can't...
Well, we might allow a little polite browbeating, but nothing more.
Well, at least we can toss him in a blanket.
No. No violence of any kind, Carol.
He doesn't play the violins. He plays the piano.
No more puns, Groucho, please. We've got to keep this on an intellectual level.
Well, that's a fine spot to put us in, I must say.
Perhaps I can be of assistance.
Yes, we'd welcome your ideas, Jose.
The purpose of the American initiation, as I understand the institution, is to make fun of the one whom you profess to honor. Is that not so?
Yes, that's just about it, Jose. How should we handle this cagey customer?
I think we must draw him out. From the way this Iturbi talks, I imagine he thinks he's pretty good.
If you ask me, he is.
Now, that's not getting us anywhere, Carol.
So we play on his vanity. Flatter him till he's all puffed up like a rooster. Then the first thing he knows, you kick him in the shins and he lays an egg.
You must come out to the farm sometime and kick my rooster in the shins.
Hey, wait a minute. Who's being initiated here, Iturbi or us?
These are only suggestions, Mr. Grant. If you have a better idea...
No, go ahead. I can see now the initiation committee is incompetent, immaterial, and irrelevant.
Well, we have one thing to go on. This Iturbi seems to fancy himself as a pianist. At least, he goes about the country offering himself for hire as a piano player. And I imagine he thinks he knows just about all there is to know about piano playing.
He certainly knows a lot about roosters.
So, we surprise this poor musician. We say, all right, Iturbi, you know so much. Let's hear you swing.
Yes.
And then poor Iturbi, he goes to the piano. And he blushes. And he bites his nails. And he does more or less like this.
The Otsne, isn't he?
Thank you, Idle Bay. And if you want some serious music, we do something quite modern. For instance, the processional march by Philippe Lazar.
I think you're going to fill a long felt want in this club. Fellow members, you have heard the candidacy, Turby. What is your pleasure?
I move that he's made a member quickly. Like that.
Second the motion.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Attention, please. Candidate Turby, stand forward.
Okie doke, Mr. President.
Jose Iturbi, for your distinguished service to the cause of music, for valuable contribution toward the elimination of the stuffed shirt from the concert platform, for the removal of much of the odium from the podium, for your smile, and for your terrific swing bass, I hereby declare you a member of the circle. That's right. Just draw up a chair, Jose. The next item on the agenda for tonight is the matter of Ravelli and his $15.
El Presidente.
Mr. Marxall.
How are things?
How do you mean?
When do we get down to business? I'm a busy man. I could be at home right now with my stamp album and my white mice.
What is it you want to know, Groucho?
I won't mince words, Coleman. How's the Treasury?
Well, as a matter of fact, it's a little early, perhaps, for an annual report, if that's what you mean. But I'm happy to be able to say that so far everything's okie-dokie, as they say in musical circles.
I wondered where that came from. But could you break that down a little, that okie-dokie? I mean, could you make it plain Okie for a while, huh? Well, not Jack Okie, because we don't want the Jack put in the wrong place. As a stockholder, I'd like to know what's behind all this optimism.
Oh, pure animal spirits, Groucho. I heard a lark sing before breakfast.
Coleman, I like a lark myself now and then, but there's a time and place for everything. What we want is facts.
Well, then, the status of the Treasury remains just about quo.
Just about quo? Do you think that's good?
It's not bad.
It's not good.
It's not hay.
No, and it's not okie-dokie. We're not spending enough. Cold feet and frozen credit. That's what put the country where it is today. And it won't do us any good either.
What would you suggest?
Now you're talking. If the club could find it in its heart to lend me a nominal sum, say, 15 smackers.
Sorry, Groucho. No. Our heart is where our treasure is, in Battle Creek, Michigan. And if you must have a report, the treasurer's accredited representative stands willing and ready. Mr. Fraser?
Here's a brand new idea for a cold weather breakfast. An idea that already, in a few short months, has given thousands of people one of the pleasantest surprises of their lives. It's Kellogg's new piping hot breakfast. You simply won't believe how marvelous it tastes until you try it. And easy, why, it's ready before the coffee perks. It's the brand new winter way of serving Kellogg's Corn Flakes. And here's how you do it. Simply put some Kellogg's Corn Flakes in a pan and heat them thoroughly in the oven. Then, just before eating, pour on hot milk or cream. Even before you taste it, you'll notice a wonderful, rich, malty fragrance that tells you how delicious it's going to be. But here's something important to remember. The secret that makes it such a success is a flavor secret discovered by Kellogg more than 30 years ago and guarded behind locked doors ever since. No one has ever succeeded in copying it. So don't expect to get the same flavor thrill from cheap cornflakes flavored the ordinary way. Ask your grocer tomorrow for a package of genuine Kellogg's cornflakes, the largest selling ready-to-eat cereal in America. Serve them just as they come from the package. They're delicious that way, as everyone knows. Or for a special treat on a winter morning, serve them this new way, piping hot.
Oh, life at its best is a tussle. Survival requires brain and muscle. In Kellogg's you get it, your forefathers get it. Their strength in the flakes, very ruffle.
Well played, Mr. Fraser and Fossum. We now proceed to further unfinished business.
Such as what, by any chance?
Well, one item seems to involve you, Groucho, oddly enough.
I was afraid of that, oddly enough.
Yes, you and the janitor, Ravelli.
You'll be telling me next I owe Ravelli money.
As a matter of fact, that's just what he's been telling me.
As a matter of fact, why should you take what he says as a matter of fact?
Well, how about it? This money he talks about, Is there anything in it?
Nothing in it for you, Coleman. And very little for me. What money? I never even heard of it. I don't know what the man's talking about. What man?
Well, I think we'd better have the janitor in if we're going to get to the bottom of this. Does anyone know where Ravelli is? Mr. Beadle, would you be good enough to...
Oi! Oi! Ravelli! Ravelli!
Somebody calling me, boss?
Yeah, Ravelli, is this gentleman the one who...
Yeah, that's the guy right there. Last week I gave him a $15 for getting me into this club.
Ravelli, don't change the subject. I thought I told you to get that piano tuned for a Turby.
What do you mean? It is tuned. I tuned it myself.
And it was very nicely tuned.
Is it my fault if you don't know how to play so good? I tuned it okay.
Good gracious, the Betsy man. Do you know who Jose is?
I don't care who he is. I could have made better music on a steamer radiator than that guy does on a piano.
Signora Tabi, I want to apologize for the way this boor has insulted you. I consider it unforgivable, and I hope you do.
I'm sure Mr. Ravelli meant no harm. His pride as a piano tuner has been hurt. We artists are all impulsive at times. Now, will you please excuse me? Hasta la vista.
Say, boss, he's a nice little guy.
Yes,
eh?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, how about my $15?
Ravelli, I have to admire a man who can discuss trivialities at a time like this. Did you hear what a Turby just said?
What?
Hasta la vista.
Yeah, what is it?
Hasta la vista means just one thing to a Spaniard.
What?
A duel.
A duel? Hey, boss, he didn't act like he was a mad.
He was just putting that on. That was his dual personality. It's the field of honor for you, my bucko.
Yeah, and that reminds me. How about my $15?
The field of honor at dawn.
Dawn? Now, that's too early. I gotta get us some sleep.
Well, I might be able to arrange to have a Turby come over and stab you in bed.
That's okay if you don't wake me up.
Oh, but that wouldn't be cricket.
Who's playing cricket? There's a man after me with a knife.
Ravelli, by this time tomorrow, you'll be just a memory.
Yeah, thanks for the memory.
Well, it was fun while you lasted, wasn't it, Ravelli?
Hey, I'm not dead yet.
You meet under the trees at dawn, and he gives you your choice of weapons. He takes a sword.
Yeah, I take a battleship.
No trickery, Ravelli. You'll take a sword. You salute. En garde. It may be thrust. He thrusts again. Now he's out for the lunge.
Why can't we all go out for lunch? Hey, look, boss, I got an idea. I think I stay home and listen to this fight on the radio.
Pay attention now, Ravelli. Let me show you how to hold the sword.
You hold the Toby. I'll hold the sword.
Hasta la vista.
Yeah.
It's going to be a slaughter. What fun. He'll run you through as easily as he runs through a cadenza.
Hey, why can't he fight Cadenza first? I'll take him on afterwards.
Shame, Ravelli, for shame. It's an honor to be barbecued by a Turby. He's really doing you a favor. Now for the next step. You advance. You never press. Your right foot forwards and your knee is bent. Two steps forward and two steps back. Doing the Lambeth walk. Oh! Ravelli, think how happy all your descendants will be when they see you stuffed and hanging over the family fireplace. Think how proud your children will be of you.
Boss, I gotta know kids.
Ravelli, how can you say that? The world is full of children. Homes full of children. Schools full of children. Playpens, playgrounds, play streets. Central Park, Riverside Drive, Coney Island.
All out, end of the line.
Children. Teeny-weeny children. Itsy-bitsy children. Look, Ravelli, 10 tiny sticky fingers are clutching at your heart. Oh, look at those cruddy cheeks, those chubby locks. See those innocent eyes. Tenderly, you hold him in your arms, a sunny boy. A rock-a-bye, my baby. He's yours, Ravelli, he's yours.
Kiss me, boss, I'm a mama.
Perfect. Perfect, that solves the problem.
Well, now we can't fight no duel.
Oh, you can't back out now. Everything is ready.
Yeah, but my kid needs me.
Oh. Oh, no, you don't, Ravelli. You've got to fight this duel. I've got the peanut concession.
Well, I can't make it so early in the morning. I got to get my kid a hot breakfast and get him to school.
All right, then we'll put it off till after breakfast.
Yeah, but I got to wash the dishes, to clean up the house, and get the kid home for a hot lunch.
If that kid of yours would eat less, we could fight this duel between those hot meals.
And after lunch, I take him back to school. Then I go shopping, get to the groceries, and after that, I have to pick up the kid again.
Ravelli, you're throwing your life away for that kid.
He'll never appreciate what you're doing. He'll grow up, get married, and forget you.
Yeah, ain't it the truth?
Yeah, they're all alike, ain't they?
Well, he sure keeps me busy, that kid. At 5 o'clock, he gets his gruel. At 5:30, he gets his sweetbuck. Then he gets his hot dinner at 6 o'clock sharp, right on the nose.
That's certainly a strange place to get his dinner. Maybe you could sneak out and fight the duel after his dinner.
What, and letting my kid go to bed on an empty stomach?
Well, you must have some time off somewhere.
Well, now let me think. The kid's in the kindergarten. Then I got to see him through grammar school. Then I got to see him through high school. After that, I got to put him through college.
I hope you're not thinking of a postgraduate course.
Sure, and maybe after the kids are grown up and out of college, he can fight the duel, eh?
But it's Ivy will be too old.
All right, then I'll fight him. And boss, if you don't mind, I want my $15. I can use it to run the house on.
I refuse to talk about that $15.
Will you talk about 5 of it? The kid needs some braces for his teeth.
Well, I need braces for my pants. Now get that fresh kid out of here. Tell him to stay off the property. I don't want him around, see?
Hey, now look. You're going to say anything you want about me. But you can't talk like that about my kid.
I'm sorry I brought the kid up.
You didn't bring him up. I brought him up. I'm his mom, and you can't talk like that about my kid. We need the money. I want my $15, see? I want my $15.
He wants his $15. He wants his $15. That's why the fellow hollered. He wants his $15.
Did you ever, ever, ever see such impecuniosity?
That may fool you, but it don't fool me. I want my $15.
His measly $15.
I will admit, I use my wit to hoodwink my competitors. On some far beach, I love to sit, evading all my creditors. But what I do, I must do well. That's always my ambition. And $15 is a bagatelle to a man in my position.
His questionable position is eminently ludicrous, precarious position.
This man now stands where fine folks tread. I saved him from the gutter. I tried to make the rat well bred. He wants both sides with butter. For helping out a pal I'm sued. That's fine, that is, that's funny. I can't face such ingratitude. Besides, he's out of money.
He's completely out of money. A devastating, perfectly appalling lack of money.
I want my $15.
Hi.
I want my $15.
No,
that man is back with the same old crack. He wants his $15. What would you do with a paltry $15, honey?
$15 put out at a reasonable rate of interest over a considerable period of time is a lot of money.
15 juicy smackers would keep a man in crackers.
15 smart simoleons would keep me in Napoleons.
Money, 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 money.
Don't make me laugh.
Don't make me sore. I tell you now what I said before. I want my $15.
$1, $2, $3, $4.
Sorry, boss, but I gotta have more bucks.
You make me sick, that's what I'm through. I'm cut to the quick.
And about time, too.
Don't pull any tricks, and I do mean you. I want my $15.
My friend, you're out of luck.
You mean to say I'm stuck?
You go on strike.
I've struck.
Before he runs amok, advance the guy a buck.
What the ducket?
A drop in the bucket. Buck, 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 bucket.
I want my $15.
Say, hold that guy, you cluck.
He swings, but Groucho ducks.
Shuck. Here's your $15. Oh, mama, here's your $15.
Ring out, oh, joy, it's felt in peace at last we dwell.
Ring out, oh, joy, it's felt.
Circle, like the network, will kindly pull itself together. Carey?
Present.
You were instructed last week to find out the whole truth about those bells. Have you done so?
I have.
Out with it then, Beeble.
Well, okay, Ronnie. Now look, the bell notes serve as a cue to operators all over the country to switch circuits in order that local stations can give out their call letters, you see? And that has to be done because of regulations for the public good, made and enforced by the Federal Communications Commission. I have a copy of that regulation right here, Mr. President.
Well, let's hear it, Carrie. I think we ought to get to the bottom of this thing.
Okay, Bobby. Licensee of a broadcast station shall announce the call letters and location as frequently as practicable during hours of operation. And in any event before or after each program being broadcast. In no event shall more than 30 minutes elapse between such announcements. And insofar as practicable, these announcements shall be made on the hour and half hour. These requirements are waived when such announcements would interrupt a single consecutive speech, play, symphony concert, or operatic production of longer duration than 30 minutes. And in such cases, the announcement of the call letters and locations shall be made as soon as possible.
Why they ring those bells.
To our Beadle, a pat on the back. To our Mr. Fraser, oh, a golden opportunity.
More than 30 years ago, Kellogg's Corn Flakes, the original Corn Flakes, were introduced to America. Ever since that time, this famous brand, Kellogg's, have been the largest selling ready-to-eat cereal in the world. Now, you know that this didn't happen by accident or luck. When millions of American families prefer one brand of cornflakes to all others over such a long period of time, there must be a good reason for it. And there is. It's the world-famous flavor of Kellogg's cornflakes that has made them the nation's favorite through all these years. And that flavor can be found only in genuine Kellogg's cornflakes. It's the result of a special secret recipe discovered by Kellogg more than 30 years ago and guarded behind locked doors ever since. No one has ever succeeded in copying it. Enjoy Kellogg's Corn Flakes just as they come from the package, crisp and golden brown. Or the new way that's making such a hit, piping hot. Either way, you'll understand why their famous flavor has made them the favorite of American families for more than a quarter of a century. Next time you buy Corn Flakes, say Kellogg's and be sure.
Oh, mothers are so superstitious. They feed us those lumpy old dishes. When Kellogg is faring, no effort preparing, a cornflake that's truly delicious.
The battle cry of Battle Creek. Pull up a chair, Mr. Fraser, and the foursome. Pull up five chairs.
Let's get three chairs, Mr. Fraser.
Yes, indeed. Anything we can do for you, Mr. Fraser? Anything in the way of music you'd like to hear? Just say the word.
Well, I am exceedingly fond of ghost stories, Mr. President, like the one Mr. Grant told us last week.
Well, how about it, Gary? Any more phantom bus drivers?
No, thanks. What do you want to do, type me?
Well, has anyone else met any interesting...
Hey, Ronnie,
ghosts?
Ronnie, how about the strange case of the doctor and the holdup man?
Do you think Mr. Fraser might like that?
Sure he would. I'd like to hear it again myself. Come on.
All right, but remember, Mr. Fraser, you brought it on yourself. Well, this is one of those things. It didn't happen to me. It was told to me by a friend of mine, a doctor. I'll try and give it to you in the doctor's own words, just as he tells it. Some years ago, he begins, I was driving to New York to attend a medical convention. I was on the road somewhere in Pennsylvania when this happened. It was late, just on midnight, and I was driving very slowly because of a dense fog. Suddenly, a swaying blur of light loomed up ahead. Dimly, very dimly, I was able to distinguish the figures of two men. They were walking down the road toward me, each with a rifle under his arm. One of them had a sort of canteen slung over his shoulder. The other was wearing a tattered jacket, a jacket that looked as if it had once belonged to some kind of a uniform. I gave them plenty of room on the road and was going to drive past when one of them called to me. It was a commanding voice, hoarse, almost hollow in the misty darkness.
Stop! In the name of mercy, stop!
You hear them, mister? Stop or we'll shoot!
Well, what do you want?
You don't have to be afeard, mister.
We don't aim to hurt you.
What's your trade?
I'm a doctor. Why?
A doctor, eh?
You're the man we want.
He'll do proper, I'm thinking.
You better come out of that, mister.
Double time and decent-like.
Has someone been hurt?
It's for you to say if he's been maybe killed.
Will you come along, mister?
Yes, I'll come. Let me get out. Well, where is he?
Yonder, under the tree where we laid him.
Say, would you mind telling me who you are? You'll admit this is all a little unusual.
Raise your lantern, Eben.
Aye. Good Lord.
That's Eben. I'm Zeke.
But what's happened? All that blood. Has there been an accident? Those bandages soaking wet. What happened?
Mischief has happened, stranger.
This way, mister. This way.
Keep close. Follow the lantern.
What's it all about? I don't like it.
None of us likes it. What must be must, it ain't our doing.
I may as well tell you now. If someone's been shot, I'll have to report it to the police.
Do that. Sure, you do that.
You may be sure I will.
Here we are. There's your man, mister.
Hey, bring that light closer, will you?
Aye.
That's better. Now, let's see. Good heavens.
Well, what are you staring at?
It's bad in the chest like that, I reckon.
Pulse is racing. How long has he been like this?
A long time, mister. Is he bad?
Hand me that bag. Quickly.
Aye.
Here. Lend a hand with these retractors. Come on, quickly, man. More retraction. That's it. Yeah, back a little bit more. So.
Bad, ain't he?
Bad enough. But the bullet didn't touch any lung tissue, far as I can see. Well, all I can do is to plug the wound. I've never seen anything like it.
You're young, mister. Lots of things you've never seen.
That cotton, please. Thanks. Lucky for him, his lung didn't collapse. That's it. Now, help me move him.
What for?
What for? We've got to get this man to a hospital.
He won't bleed to death, will he?
No, not with that plug in there.
All right, then. We're much obliged to you.
But I tell you, that man's dangerously wounded.
He'll be all right now, thanks to you.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way about it. But I'm reporting this to the Pennsylvania State Police at the first telephone station I reach.
Maybe you won't reach no station.
Let him go, Zeke. Fog's lifting. If we killed, mister, it was none of our wishing. What's done is done.
On your way, then, stranger. We don't want any more trouble. There's been trouble and grieving enough, and we've had our share and more. We've killed and we've been hurt for it. We're not alone. You can go now.
And our thanks to you. You can go, and thanks in the name of mercy. In the name of mercy, we thank you.
Where's your telephone? I've just been held up.
Yeah?
Yes, two of them, with rifles. But they won't be hard to identify. Bearded, both of them. Faces bandaged, covered with dirt and blood. Friend of theirs with a gaping chest wound. I'm a doctor, so they forced me to attend him.
Oh, them fellas, huh?
Oh, you know them. Well, they're desperate, I tell you, and armed.
About 2 miles down the road, would you say?
Yes, just about that. Now, if you'll show me your phone and tell me the name of that town I just passed. Well, come on, what town is that back there?
That's Gettysburg, mister.
Gettysburg.
Yeah? Gettysburg. And Gettysburg Battlefield. When it's light, you can see the gravestones. Meade's men, Pickett's men, and Robert E. Lee's.
Then those men were...
Yes. You're not the first they passed in the fog, nor the last.
Gettysburg. And the restless dead.
Yeah, that's right. Fill her up, mister?
Yes. Yes, yes, fill her up. Yes.
Gentlemen, dear gentlemen, this thing has got to stop. Enough is enough. Last week we had phantom bus drivers, and this week we've got phantom soldiers. It's getting so I expect every stranger I meet is going to vanish in a puff of smoke.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that. Most of them don't vanish. They follow you home and sit on the foot of your bed, gibbering. Gibber, gibber, gibber.
I remember once a ghost came up and asked for my autograph. I sent for my ghost rider, and I was just about...
Ronnie, they're at it again.
Well, now, of course, some of the strangers you meet are real flesh and blood strangers. Only 9 out of 10 are ghosts.
Ronnie.
Well, you can't always spot them right away. Now, take, for instance, the fellow who just came in, the one standing behind you now, Carol.
I won't look.
No, Carol, I shouldn't. At first, I thought he was just an ordinary guy, a page boy or a vice president. And then I happened to notice that he hasn't any face.
That settles it.
Now, let's spare the secretary's nerves. There's a cure for her jitters or jibbers. How about some soft music? Have we any soft music in the stock, Mr. Dolan?
Mr. Eterby came equipped with a full set, Mr. President. Soft and loud.
For example?
For example, the finale of the Liszt Concerto in E-flat.
As they used to say in Madrid, ole.
Ole!
Carol, did Jose's music bring back your poise?
Oh, yes, it really fixed me up. You know, if the graveyard yawned now, I'd yawn right back at it.
Lombard's chipper again. And when Lombard is chipper, there's trouble ahead.
Pardon me, Carrie, but I can't agree with you. In my little experience with women...
Oh, I wouldn't be despondent, senior. You're young yet.
I said in my little experience with women...
Oh, don't be despondent, senior. You're young yet.
Hey, Carrie, I said that.
My little experience with women...
Oh, that's what you said. Yeah.
A woman in good spirit is not dangerous at all.
Uh-huh.
It is the woman in bad spirit who can be as fascinating, as dangerous as a tiger.
Maybe Carol can settle the argument. We'd like to have a feminine point of view.
No, oh, you would you?
Why, yes, of course.
Mm-mm, I refuse to be trapped.
I'm not in a trapping mood, Carol. You can always tell when I set out to snare innocent young females because I wear a long black cloak and a tulip in my lapel.
Don't be despondent. You're young yet, Ronnie.
Very true. But right now I'm trying to do right by Arnell.
Yeah, but I know what you're after. You want me to say what I think so you and your henchmen can sit back and sneer.
50 million henchmen can't be wrong.
But why should we sneer, Carol?
Because you always do when women try to be intelligent. Because all men are women haters at heart.
Oh, I don't hate women. Of course, I don't think they'll ever replace the old-fashioned shaving mug, but that's how it goes.
Yes.
Different thing, you know.
You can mark my words, Cary Grant. Someday we'll have a woman president. What do you say about that?
She'll never be the father of her country.
But nothing but a technicality. You're deliberately trying to belittle the idea and bemuddle the issue. If there's anything I hate more than a belittler, it's a bemuddler. And you're a bemuddler.
Oh, no, I didn't say a woman couldn't be president. Well, maybe she could.
I know how you feel about it. You're scared. A woman will only get to be president over your dead body, which might be a very good idea.
Well, now, look, Carol, I can't answer for the rest of the men, but I'd probably vote for this hypothetical woman.
Yes, come to think of it, I guess you would. You'd want her to get elected so you could take your dimples down to Washington and profile your way into the cabinet.
No, I'm just curious. I'd like to toss a woman into the White House to see what would happen.
Well, what would happen, Carol?
Well, I'll tell you what would happen. If a woman ran, women ran this world, it would be a better world, if you really want to know. It wouldn't be such a sorry mess of a world. It wouldn't be the kind of a world that bombs kids in the street and taxes their parents to pay for the bombs. It'd be a world where people were starved with surplus for stuff to eat around them. It'd be a cleaner place, saner place, and a finer place. Because why? Because women are realists. They wouldn't permit war because everybody knows nobody can win a war. They wouldn't permit slums and filth and disease and poverty because those things cost everybody money. Do you know what causes war and poverty? All right, I'll tell you. Male stupidity, male sentiment, and male greed. Oh, I know women are greedy too, but they know how to get what they want, you know. They don't let stupid, sentimental considerations get in their way. They wouldn't start a war to get a new trade or raw materials or a swell head when they know darn well they'll end up headless and bankrupt. It all comes down to this. Men are children and women are realists. Take it or leave it, gents. Take it or leave it.
Whew. My, my. What an orator Arnell turned out to be.
Anybody want to play a game of rummy?
You can deal me in and say if the foursome would favor us briefly.
Good night.
Well, well, well. Swelp me, Bob. Arnell has gone often enough. 7-9, Groucho. What'd you do?
9 card. Deuce is wild, gentlemen.
All right, I'm in.
A little girl called Nell, and everybody liked our Nell quite well. But one summer day, Nellie strayed away. Now we're wondering what became of Nell. She took her roller skates upon that day and skated to some woods not far away. In these woods, they say, great big monsters stay. Now we're wondering which one ate our Nell.
Oh, maybe an operator,
maybe a radiator,
maybe a percolator,
maybe a sweet potato,
maybe an elevator,
maybe a decorator.
Well, 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 who can tell who in the Samuel ate our Nell?
Maybe an incubator,
maybe an escalator,
maybe an imitator,
maybe a gladiator.
What could be the fate that took Carol on a skate? Nellie Gray. They have taken her away, and we'll never see our darling anymore.
Maybe a legislator, maybe an arbitrator, maybe an agitator, maybe a commentator.
If Nellie's been eight, send her back, we'll pay the freight. Bring back our darling Carol.
King, Queen, Jack, and Ten of Diamonds, gents, and out. Has anybody seen Arnell?
Arnell is back, but she's still in enough.
Oh, now there, little one. We really appreciated your speech. As a matter of fact, that's what this club needs. I've had a couple of letters about it myself. I'd like to read one of them if the chair is willing.
All attention, Kerry.
All right, well, now this fellow writes, enjoyed your stuff and nonsense last Sunday, but for my money, I'll take more stuff and less nonsense. Give us something we can get our teeth into. You can't ignore forever the storms and passions now sweeping the world. What concerns radio listeners concerns you, and you had better find that out.
He's right. The boy's right.
Yeah, I don't care, but the minute you start that, you run smack into the problem of propaganda. How are you going to get around that?
What's the matter with propaganda? Some of my best friends are propagandists, Carrie. You, for instance, you're a propagandist for cornflakes. And Gunga Din and cornflakes.
Yeah.
And Gunga Din. Cornflakes.
Oh, Carrie, the words got you scared, that's all. Listen, you know, every
and
man who... Yes, whoever opens his mouth is a propagandist for something. You know, anybody with brains enough to have an opinion is a propagandist because right away he's out trying to sell it to somebody else.
It's only when propaganda is restricted and regulated that it's dangerous, when only one side of any argument can be presented.
Yeah, I know, Ronnie, but people are so gullible. People are fall for anything. If some fella comes along with something he wants to put over, all he has to do is be convincing. He doesn't have to be right. He doesn't even have to believe it himself. He just has to know the truth. And how they're working on people, isn't
well,
that right?
Well, that's true of any salesman, isn't it?
Well, Lincoln had an answer for that one. You can't fool all the people all of the time. It's been kicked around by every comedian in show business, Groucho, but it's still true.
That's right. The very foundation of a democratic government like ours is the assumption that its citizens have sense enough to know what's good for them, to distinguish right from wrong and truth from falsehood, provided they have all the facts and nothing is kept from them. Free speech is important because it's a safeguard against one-sided propaganda of any kind and against having anything put over on us.
Well, I'm not opposing free speech, Ronnie. Don't try to hang that on me. I'm just saying that once we start that sort of discussion, we've got to go the whole way, throw it wide open. If we can't, I think it's better not to get into it, don't you?
Listen, I'm going to read you something I came across the other day.
All right, shoot.
Something that has a bearing on all this.
No more phantoms, Ronnie.
No. This is very real, Carol. It concerns a certain teacher of philosophy abroad. Some of you are probably familiar with his work. Anyway, he was rather outspoken in his criticism of the government of his country, which shall be nameless. And he was thrown into jail on charges amounting to treason. They gave him a choice of retracting everything he had taught and conforming from then on, or death. He chose death. A reporter who was present at the trial made a transcript from memory of the man's last words to the judges who had condemned him. I'll read part of it. He said, "Not much will be gained, gentlemen, in return for the evil name which you will have earned from the detractors of this country, who will say that you murdered a wise man. For they will call me wise, whether I am or not, when they want to reproach you. I had not, however, the impudence or inclination to address you as you would have liked me to address you, weeping and wailing and lamenting, and saying and doing many things which you have been accustomed to hear from others, but which, as I say, are unworthy of me. Nor do I now repent the manner of my defense. I would rather die, having spoken in my own manner, than speak in your manner and live. There are ways of avoiding death, if a man is willing to do and say anything. The difficulty, my friends, is not in avoiding death, but in avoiding unrighteousness, for that runs faster than death. Gentlemen who have condemned me, I am going to prophesy to you, for I am about to die, and that is the hour in which men are said to be gifted with prophetic power. I prophesy to you who are my murderers that immediately after my death, punishment far heavier than you have inflicted on me will surely await you. Me you have killed because you wanted to escape public censure, but that will not be as you suppose. Far otherwise. for I predict that you will have more accusers than you have now. Accusers whom up to now I have restrained. And as they are younger, they will be more severe with you, and you will find them harder to brook. If you think that by killing men you can suppress criticism of your actions, you are mistaken. The way to do that is not by crushing others, but by improving yourselves. Bear this in mind, too, that no evil can come to a good man, either in life or after death. I see clearly that to die and be released from this world is best for me, and that is why it was ordained. For that reason also, I am not angry with my accusers or my condemners, for you have done me no real harm, although neither did you intend to do me any good, and for that I may gently blame you. The hour of departure has arrived, and we go our ways. I to die, and you to live. Which is better, God only knows. Well, the old professor went his way, but his followers, as he prophesied, still speak out against intolerance and injustice and oppression. The professor, as you have probably guessed, was Socrates. And the reporter was Plato.
Plato. Me on a bill with Plato. Popo, Chico, Groucho, and Plato. Say, we could use that guy.
Say, did you have something to say, Groucho?
Top Plato? Not me. I have a tough time topping Ravelli.
What's the moral, Ronnie?
Moral. We've a fine country here. Let's keep it that way. Let freedom ring. And, incidentally, let Mr. Fraser through, please.
Mothers are especially enthusiastic about Kellogg's new piping hot breakfast that's fast becoming America's favorite way of starting the day. For here's one good, warm, nourishing breakfast that youngsters eat without urging. It's good for them, too, and it's so easy to prepare. Just put some Kellogg's cornflakes in a pan and heat them thoroughly in the oven. Then, just before eating, pour on hot milk or cream. Mm-mm. A rich, tempting fragrance tells you, even before you taste it, that something mighty good is on the way. But what makes this new hot breakfast such a treat is the special secret flavor you find only in genuine Kellogg's cornflakes. This rich, malty goodness is the result of a secret Kellogg recipe. No one has ever succeeded in copying it. So if you have a package of Kellogg's cornflakes in your pantry right now, try them this new way tomorrow. Otherwise, get a package from your grocer. But be sure to tell him you want genuine Kellogg's cornflakes, the largest selling ready-to-eat cereal in the world.
Before we adjourn, I have a communication here from one of the gang. It reads, congratulate club on landing Iturbi. Congratulate Iturbi on crashing club. Wish you were here, wish I were there. It's signed, Lawrence Tippett, Baritone on leave.
Day letter or night race?
Good old Tippett, when will he be back? Does anybody know?
A week after next, I'm glad to say. Now, any further remarks for the good of the order?
Mr. President, I'd like to propose a friend of mine for membership.
All right, the same friend, Carey, Noel Coward?
That's right. He's stopping off here for a few days next week on his way to Samoa.
The circle will be honored, and Noel will be astonished, I'm sure.
Isn't he the fellow who wrote women should be stuck regularly every like an hour like a gong?
That's right, he did, yes.
Well, he'll live to regret it next week.
Carol, I'll appoint you and Carey to devise suitable torches for our guests.
Well, then I want a paddle.
Yes, we'll strike them regularly like a gun.
We'll leave the details of the execution to the chief executioners. Meanwhile, do I hear a motion to adjourn?
Listen closely, Ronald. I move we adjourn.
Second the motion.
All those in favor?
Aye.
The second meeting of the circle stands adjourned.
The meeting stands adjourned. The meeting stands adjourned. Rosalie's gaze is wandering. The Groucho brain is pondering.
Did you ever, ever, ever see such a pretty petty larceny?
Who took that 15 bucks from me? It's gone again. I'm
the meeting stands adjourned.
Ring out your bells in peace at last you dwell. You've got a right to say goodnight. Ring out for all is well.
Twist the Circle next week with Noel Coward, in addition to the Marx Brothers, Robert Emmett Dolan, The Foursome, Cary Grant, Carol Lombard, and Ronald Coleman. This is the National Broadcasting Company.